A thin sliver of moonlight falls over the olive groves on the outskirts of Coimbra, Portugal. It is a cool spring night in 1772. Angelica Maria, a caretaker from the local foundling home, walks a narrow path up Monte Ario, her lantern casting jittery shadows among the trees. She pauses. Something on the ground catches her eye. The earth looks recently disturbed. With trembling hands, she kneels and brushes aside the topsoil. A gasp escapes her lips as the lantern's glow reveals a tiny bundle beneath, the lifeless body of an infant, hastily buried. Bruises mar the baby's delicate neck. Angelica staggers back, heart pounding. Horror washes over her. She realizes this is no lone tragedy. It is the first glimpse into an unfathomable nightmare. In the silent darkness, the foundling home caretaker whispers a prayer, unaware that her grim discovery is about to unmask a monster hiding in their midst. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. I'm Shane Waters. Thank you for joining me for episode 4 of our series, Serial Killers in History. In our last episode, we traveled to the Caribbean in 1768. Now it's 1772, and we've returned to Europe, more precisely to Portugal, to uncover a tale that defies belief. Tonight we delve into the story of Luisa de Jesus, a woman whose name will become synonymous with betrayal and blood. This is our 4th case in this series, and notably our 3rd female serial killer. But unlike the others, her weapon of choice was not poison. Instead, Luisa turned an institution of mercy into her hunting ground. How could a caregiver, entrusted with society's most vulnerable, commit such unspeakable acts under the guise of charity? By the end of this episode, we'll confront the dark truth of a killer who preyed on innocence and examine how her crimes forced a nation to rethink how it protects its children. The year is 1772. Portugal is in the throes of social upheaval under King Joseph I and his influential minister, Marquis of Pombal. Poverty is rampant, and one heartbreaking consequence is a surge in infant abandonment. Across cities like Coimbra, desperate mothers with no means to care for their newborns turn to the Casa da Rota, the foundling wheel system, hoping to save their babies' lives. The foundling wheel was a rotating wooden cylinder built into orphanage and church walls, where one could anonymously leave an infant by placing them inside and turning the wheel. A bell would chime, alerting the caretakers on the other side that a child, known as an ex posto or exposed one, now needed their care. It was a system born of compassion and desperation, intended to curb infanticide by offering a safe alternative. For each abandoned child taken in, the authorities provided a stipend of about 600 reis, a cradle, and a length of cloth as support for the caregiver. In theory, it was a life-saving charity. In practice, it was overwhelmed. Hundreds of infants were left at the Coimbra foundling wheel each year, far more than the understaffed facilities could adequately monitor. This was the world into which our story's protagonist was born. a world of good intentions and tragic vulnerabilities.
Few cases have shocked Portugal quite like that of Luísa de Jesus, an 18th century serial killer whose crimes still resonate with horror nearly three centuries later. The year was 1772, and Portugal was experiencing a period of significant social transformation under the reign of King Joseph I and his powerful minister, the Marquis of Pombal. During this time, Portugal was struggling with widespread poverty and a growing crisis of child abandonment. The streets of major cities, like Coimbra, were filled with desperate mothers who couldn't care for their infants, and a system of wet nurses and foundling homes had emerged to address this social crisis. It was within this troubled system that Luísa de Jesus would commit her horrific acts. What makes this case particularly chilling is not just the number of victims, but the calculated nature of the crimes and the exploitation of society's most vulnerable members. Luísa would become known as Portugal's first documented female serial killer, and her actions would lead to fundamental changes in how the country handled child welfare. As we delve into this dark chapter of Portuguese history, we'll explore how one woman's crimes expose the deep flaws in a system meant to protect society's most innocent members.
Luísa de Jesus was born on December 10, 1748, in a small village near Coimbra. The daughter of poor farmers, she grew up with few prospects in a society divided sharply along class lines. Little is recorded about her childhood. Notably, there's no evidence that she herself was ever a foundling. Despite the surname de Jesus, commonly given to abandoned children, that she used. In fact, parish records show she was baptized and raised by her birth parents, Manuel and Mariana Rodriguez. As a young adult, Luísa married a man named Emmanuel Gomes, though he would vanish from her story by the time it reached its darkest chapter. To earn a living, Luísa worked as a recoveira, a carrier who transported goods between the city of Coimbra and outlying villages. This humble job gave her a reason to travel frequently and mingle with various communities. Importantly, it brought her into contact with the Coimbra foundling home, the Real Casa dos Expotas. Through her deliveries and local errands, Luísa became a familiar face at the foundling wheelhouse. She often volunteered to help the staff, sometimes acting as a go-between who could ferry infants to wet nurses or foster families in distant villages. Grateful officials saw her as a godsend, a compassionate young woman willing to take in or deliver unwanted babies to those who would care for them. Luisa's humble background and friendly demeanor endeared her to the foundling home's overseers. They never imagined the wolf in sheep's clothing that lurked beneath. Over time, Luísa learned every detail of the foundling care system. She understood the bureaucracy. She knew how the intake ledgers were kept and how stipends were issued to caregivers. She knew that for each infant entrusted to a caregiver, the state would pay out those 600 reis, along with a cradle and a piece of cloth, no questions asked. And she knew the system's weaknesses: the desperate abundance of babies, the overworked staff, and the gaps in oversight that spanned across regions. By 1771, Luísa had quietly begun to test the waters of a sinister scheme. She offered to personally adopt foundlings or to collect them on behalf of supposed rural couples who couldn't make the journey to Coimbra. Each time, she filled out the prerequisite paperwork for the transfer, documents handled by a seasoned administrator named Pascoal Luis Ferreira da Silva, and walked away with an infant and the accompanying subsidy. To the foundling home, it was a relief, one less mouth to feed, and a child presumably on the way to a loving home. To Luisa, it was an opportunity. Little did anyone suspect that the seemingly kind nursemaid, who presented herself as a savior for abandoned infants, was about to exploit their trust in the most horrific way imaginable.
Luisa's intimate knowledge of the system's workings, combined with the trust she had built within the community, created the perfect cover for what would become a devastating series of crimes that would shock the entire nation. Luisa's criminal enterprise began to take shape in 1772, when she discovered she could make a considerable profit by exploiting the foundling care system. Her method was ruthlessly efficient. She would travel to different foundling homes across the region, collecting infants under the pretense of providing them with care. For each child she took in, she received payment from the authorities, typically enough money to sustain a caregiver for several months. However, instead of caring for these vulnerable infants, Luisa would murder them shortly after receiving payment. She would then move on to another foundling home in a different town, where she wasn't known, and repeat the process. The bureaucratic gaps between different jurisdictions and the poor record-keeping of the time allowed her to continue this horrific cycle without detection for many months. Luisa's preferred method of killing was strangulation, though she occasionally resorted to suffocation as well. She would typically commit these murders within days of receiving the children, ensuring she could maximise her profits while minimising the time and resources spent on actually caring for the infants. After each murder, she would dispose of the tiny bodies in remote locations, often burying them in shallow graves or abandoning them in wooded areas. The precise number of victims has never been definitely established, but during her eventual confession, Luisa admitted to murdering 33 infants over the course of just under a year. This makes her one of history's most prolific infant killers. The systematic nature of her crimes was unprecedented. She treated the murder of these children as a business, carefully selecting her victims and maintaining a routine that allowed her to avoid detection. What made her crimes particularly shocking was the calculated way she exploited a system designed to protect society's most vulnerable members. She took advantage of both the financial support offered by the state and the trust placed in her as a caregiver. The foundling homes, desperate to find placements for the overwhelming number of abandoned infants, were easy targets for her scheme.
For months, Luis de Jesus carried on her murderous fraud without anyone suspecting a thing. She was careful, spacing out her visits to the foundling wheel so that no obvious pattern would raise alarm. Each time she arrived, the staff handed over another infant and another payment, gratefully recording a fake name of some distant adopter that Luisa had invented. No follow-up inquiries were made. After all, once a child left with a caregiver, it was assumed they were in good hands. But the illusion of safety could not last forever. April 1st, 1772, the early spring morning when Angelica Maria stumbled upon that shallow grave on Monte Arroyo and uncovered a tiny strangled corpse. As word of the grim discovery spread, local authorities descended upon the area. Shovels struck dirt, and soon, two more infant bodies were unearthed from the cold ground. Each one a newborn, recently entrusted to the foundling home, now dead with bruises encircling its neck. The community was aghast. Who could commit such an atrocity? Investigators quickly retraced the fate of these babies and found a common thread. The last person seen with them was a woman matching Luisa de Jesus' description. The caretaker Angelica, horrified by what she had uncovered, told officials that Luisa had just taken her two infants from the foundling home days prior. Suspicion fell immediately on the 23-year-old woman who had once been considered a benefactor. Luisa was promptly detained for questioning. At first, she maintained a steely calm and swore her innocence, insisting that the infants in her care had simply taken ill and died of natural causes. It was a thin lie, and it unraveled almost immediately. Investigators confronted her with the evidence from Monte Arroyo in the foundling home's records. There were no signs of these children being delivered to any of the families Luisa had listed in the paperwork. Pressed harder, Luisa's facade began to crack. Within hours of interrogation, some accounts say by April 6th, she offered a chilling partial confession, admitting that she had killed the three infants found on the hillside. Yet, as shocking as that admission was, it was only the beginning. The authorities sensed that a far larger horror lay below the surface, and they were right. Under magistrate orders, a team of searchers were dispatched to Luisa's small cottage on the outskirts of town. What they discovered there would sear itself into Portuguese history. Buried in the dirt floor of her home was an unthinkable cache of human remains. The searchers uncovered a large clay pot hidden beneath a few loose boards. Inside were decomposed body parts of infants, a foul stench escaping from the container. Counting by tiny skulls, they realized multiple children had been dumped together in that pot. Nearby, under a pile of straw, lay four more infant skulls, their delicate bones gnawed by decay. Even the most hardened officers retched at the sight. And still, there was more. Digging further, authorities found 10 small skull caps buried in a corner of the hut's earthen floor. Evidence of infants who had been completely deboned or dismembered earlier in Luisa's killing spree. It was as if they had stumbled into a charnel house. Altogether, the investigators recovered the remains of 18 children from Luisa's home alone. Combined with the bodies exhumed on Monte Arroyo, which eventually totaled 15, the count of victims found reached a staggering 33 infants. Luisa de Jesus, confronted with this mountain of damning evidence, finally broke. Over the course of several days, she confessed in detail to 28 murders, one by one, in a disturbingly matter-of-fact manner. She recounted how she would tie a strip of cloth tightly around each baby's neck, the very strips found carelessly discarded in her home, and strangle them shortly after leaving the city. She described carrying the tiny corpses up the hill to Monte Arroyo, under cover of darkness, or hiding them under her floorboards until she could dispose of them.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile. And you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At times, she even admitted to dismembering the bodies of her earliest victims, perhaps to better conceal several remains in one burial spot. Throughout these confessions, investigators noted with revulsion that Luisa showed little to no remorse. According to contemporary reports, she answered questions possessed of ambition and ferocity, with her profits and indifferent to the suffering she caused. Her chilling lack of emotion, as if she were discussing the slaughter of chickens rather than babies, left even seasoned magistrates pale and shaken. As Luisa spoke, officials cross-checked her statements with the Foundling Home's ledgers. The pattern became clear. Over the past year, 34 children in total had been entrusted to Luisa de Jesus' care. Of those, 33 bodies had now been found, either at Monte Arroyo or in her house. Only one infant, the 34th, remained unaccounted for, its fate unknown. Luisa refused to divulge what happened to that missing child. An eerie mystery that hung over the case and fueled public outrage even more. It was evident to the authorities that Luisa had methodically lied on official documents, creating fictitious names and addresses so that no real foster family would come forward asking where a child was. Shockingly, the administrator, Pascual Silvia, had signed off on all of these false records, essentially rubber-stamping Luisa's kidnapping and murder spree out of negligence or worse. He, along with two women who operated the foundling wheel, the Rodiera, and an internal wet nurse, were arrested as accomplices for their failure to oversee the process properly. The public, now learning of these developments, was furious, not only at Luisa, but at the entire system that had allowed her crimes to go undetected. By late April 1772, the investigation had laid bare the full scope of Luisa's atrocities. In the official summary by the magistrates, they concluded grimly, 34 children had left the foundling wheel. 33 were found dead, and it is evident that Luisa de Jesus dispatched them all in the same cruel manner, robbing not only their lives, but the kingdom of their future citizens. There was never any doubt about the outcome of this case. Portugal had never seen a murderer like Luisa de Jesus, the deadliest serial killer in its history, and there was an overwhelming cry for justice.
As investigators pieced together the timeline of her crimes, they were struck by the systematic nature of her operation. She had maintained detailed records of payments received, and had even kept track of burial locations, which aided in the recovery of many of her victims. The investigation ultimately confirmed the deaths of 33 infants, though some historians believe the actual number might be higher. The trial of Luisa de Jesus began in the summer of 1773, drawing unprecedented attention from across Portugal. The court proceedings held in Coimbra became a sensation that touched every level of Portuguese society. The details revealed during the trial painted a picture of calculated cruelty that left the nation stunned. The prosecution presented overwhelming evidence, including Luisa's own meticulous records and the testimony of numerous foundling home workers. What particularly shocked the courtroom was her apparent lack of remorse. When questioned about her motives, she spoke only of the financial benefits, treating the deaths of 33 infants as mere business transactions. The defence attempted to argue that Luisa's own background as an abandoned child had damaged her psyche, but this argument gained little traction with either the judges or the public. The sentiment on the street of Coimbra was unanimously against her, with crowds gathering daily outside the courthouse demanding justice. The verdict came swiftly. The court found Luisa de Jesus guilty of all charges and sentenced her to death by hanging. But her punishment didn't end there. In a particularly severe judgment, the court ordered that her body be burnt and her ashes scattered to the winds, a punishment typically reserved for the most heinous of crimes. The case sparked intense debate about the foundling home system throughout Portugal. Questions arose about how such systematic murder could go undetected for so long. The public's trust in these institutions was severely shaken, leading to calls for reform in how abandoned children were handled and monitored.
Luisa de Jesus's sentence was as unprecedented and fierce as her crimes. On July 1st, 1772, the day of execution, thousands of people flooded into Coimbra's main square to witness the finale of this horrific saga. The authorities meant to make an example of her, and so they staged a ghastly public spectacle in the tradition of the time. Luisa, hands bound, was paraded through the streets with a coarse rope slung around her neck, while a town crier walked beside her, loudly reading out her catalogue of crimes for all to hear. As she passed by, the crowd jeered and pressed in. Some threw rotten food. Others simply stood in stunned silence at the sight of this slight, unremarkable-looking woman who had murdered with a ruthless efficiency that defied comprehension. Upon reaching the scaffold, the punishment grew even more brutal. The executioner produced a red-hot iron pincers and, following the sentence's instructions, clamped it onto Luisa's flesh, burning her as she screamed in agony. Next, in a single stroke, her hands were cut off, the very hands that had accepted money for innocent lives and carried infants to their death. Finally, as the crowd held its breath, Luisa de Jesus was garroted, the iron collar tightening around her neck until life left her body. To ensure she could never receive the dignity of a grave, the court had decreed a further humiliation. Her corpse was to be burned to ashes and scattered to the wind. In the chilling words of the 1772 judgment,
"Levada ao lugar da forca, nele lhe sejam decepadas suas mãos, depois do que morra de morte natural pelo garrote. E dado este, seja o seu corpo queimado e reduzido a cinzas, para que nunca mais haja memória de semelhante monstro."
Translation: taken to the place of execution, there her hands shall be cut off. After that, she shall die by the garrote. Once that is done, let her body be burned and reduced to ashes so that no memory remains of such a monster. When the smoke cleared that afternoon, Luisa de Jesus was dead. And with her died any notion that a woman could not be as cruel or calculating as a man. In fact, her infamy would be sealed in the history books. Luisa was the last woman ever executed in Portugal. Her case marked a turning point on the cobbled streets of Coimbra. Many cheered that justice had been served to this monster, but others in enlightened circles murmured uneasily of the barbarity of the punishment. It was the age of enlightenment, after all, and debates about crime and punishment were in the air. Some asked, had the spectacle been justice, or just another horror? Nonetheless, few truly mourned Luisa de Jesus. The overwhelming public sentiment remained one of anger and relief. Anger at the system that allowed her to prey on the innocent, and relief that the assassina da Rota, meaning the foundling wheel murderess, had met a fate as gruesome as her crimes. In the wake of Luisa's execution, Portugal was forced to take a hard look at the failings of its child welfare system. The fact that a woman could murder 33 babies under the guise of charity and nearly get away with it sent shockwaves through every foundling home in the country. investigations were launched into the Casa de Rota of Coimbra and beyond. The two Coimbra employees who had handed over infants to Luisa, the wheel caretaker Margarita Joaquina, and the nurse Luciada de Concepcion, were publicly shamed for what one historian would call criminal negligence in failing to verify the destinations of those children. They were released from jail in October 1772, having been chastened but ultimately not prosecuted as killers. The scandal provoked intense debates among officials and the public. How could the foundling system be reformed to prevent such an atrocity from ever happening again? Newspapers and pamphlets of the time questioned how the bureaucracy had become so lax that a single person could adopt dozens of infants without raising alarm. Trust in the charitable institutions was badly shaken. In response, the authorities moved swiftly to tighten oversight. New regulations were drafted for foundling homes across Portugal. Caregivers taking in infants now faced stricter monitoring. Local officials were required to conduct regular check-ins, at least monthly, to confirm the welfare of each child placed in private care. Detailed logs became mandatory, recording where each baby was sent and scheduled follow-up visits. A rudimentary central registry was proposed so that a record existed of every transfer, preventing any one person from collecting multiple stipends under false pretenses, as Luisa had. The government of Prime Minister Pombal, known for his reforms, supported harsher penalties for any official who failed to report irregularities in the system. Within a decade, these efforts culminated in a sweeping reform. In 1783, under the patronage of Queen Maria I, Portugal expanded the foundling wheel system to all towns, but with far greater supervision and funding. Local municipalities were ordered to finance foundling care and were threatened with punishment if they neglected their duties. It was a direct attempt to ensure that the tragedy of Coimbra would not be repeated. The Luisa de Jesus case also changed public attitudes. What had once been a quietly pitted corner of society, abandoned infants and the women who cared for them, now became a high-profile concern. Churches and charities saw a surge of interest from wealthy patrons spurred by the horror of the murders. Philanthropists donated money to improve conditions in orphanages, and some even established new charitable foundations dedicated to protecting unwanted children. There was a newfound recognition that these babies, often born out of wedlock or extreme poverty, needed better protection from exploitation. Some of the reforms Portugal implemented in the late 1770s and 1780s were considered among the most progressive child welfare measures in Europe at the time. For instance, authorities began performing background checks in a rudimentary 18th century form on prospective wet nurses or caregivers, rather than accepting any volunteer at face value. Severe penalties were put in place for those who abused or neglected children entrusted to them, a direct response to the realization that without accountability, the most vulnerable could be preyed upon. In short, out of the ashes of Luisa's crimes, a stronger oversight system was born. It did not happen overnight, and it certainly did not bring back the lives of those 33 innocents. But it marked a turning point. The foundling wheel continued to turn in Portugal for decades to come. But now everyone understood that simply abandoning a child to charity wasn't enough. Society had to remain vigilant about who picked that child up on the other side.
Modern interpretations of the case have focused on its broader social implications. Historians and criminologists point to Louisa de Isis as a prime example of how systematic failures in social institutions can enable serial killers to operate undetected. The case is often cited in discussions about the importance of oversight in child welfare systems and the potential consequences of inadequate monitoring. The story of Louisa de Isis continues to influence Portuguese culture and law enforcement training. Police academies use the case to teach the importance of thorough record keeping and regular monitoring of vulnerable populations. Social workers study it as a cautionary tale about the critical need for vigilance in child protection services. In recent years, scholars have also examined the case through the lens of gender and social class, noting how Louisa's position as a poor woman allowed her to exploit a system that paid little attention to those on society's margins. This analysis has contributed to ongoing discussions about social inequality and its relationship to crime and justice. The case of Louisa de Isis stands as a chilling reminder of how vulnerable members of society, particularly children, can fall victim to systematic failures and individual malice. While her crimes were horrific, they ultimately served as a catalyst for profound and necessary change in child welfare systems, not just in Portugal, but across Europe. The consequences of her actions extended far beyond the immediate tragedy of the murdered infants. The case forced society to confront uncomfortable truths about the treatment of abandoned children and the desperate circumstances that could drive someone to commit such heinous acts. The reforms that followed her execution created a foundation for modern child protection services, demonstrating how even the darkest chapters in history can lead to positive social change. As we reflect on this historical case, we're reminded that vigilance in protecting society's most vulnerable members remains as crucial today as it was in 18th century Portugal. The story of Louisa de Isis continues to serve as a powerful warning about the importance of robust oversight through documentation and the need to look beyond surface appearances when protecting those who cannot protect themselves.
Thank you for joining us for this sobering journey into the past. This is Foul Play, and I'm Shane Waters. We don't chase monsters. We uncover the damage they leave behind. The ashes of Louisa de Jesus were scattered to the winds in the attempt to erase her from memory. But her dark legacy endures, etched in the quiet graves of her victims and in the laws that rose to protect the innocent after her reign of terror. Her story reminds us that sometimes the worst monsters hide in plain sight, wearing the guise of a savior. Until next time, stay vigilant and take care of one another.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.